I just realized we've gone this whole weekend and haven't said an opening prayer or a closing prayer for anything we've done. Yeah. How about that? You say you want to start now?
Yeah.
Why don't we open this with the Serenity Prayer then?
Okay.
God? Grant me the serenity to accept the things that I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, the wisdom to know the difference. So now we've invited God in. So I finished all those fifth steps. And I was told to arrive at a pancake house on a couple of miles from where I was staying. And I knew I was going to meet some people for breakfast, but I thought it was over. I thought maybe now that we've done with the fifth step, this is about over, and I'm going to get a pat on the back and go home. And I got there, and four of the guys I had swapped fifth steps with was sitting there. And we had a nice breakfast. When one of them said, get your pen and paper out, we're going to help you with your amends list. And they had remarkable memories. They had remembered what I had talked about in all those fifth steps, the harm I had caused. And that, and so I'm literally writing down each amend as they're coming up. And I got my inventory there next to me, but I'm writing that. But then a very important question was asked of me later on about how about all those people I owed amends to that never made my resentment list? And when Paul asked that question, I looked at him and I thought, it was like he screamed it at me. I knew I had missed something. That just doing the resentment list wasn't cutting it. And so what I had was a number of people that I had harmed, and I really was not having any kind of returning thoughts about in particular. It wasn't going on with me. And so we went down with that. And time I was done with that, the people on my resentment list was a much smaller list that I owed amends to than the rest of it, because we had borrowed money from parents, both hers and mine, from friends in AA and out, from Dial Finance, from a lot of money. And there was any number of bills we'd accumulated in life that we hadn't returned to. We just walked away from. A credit card that I remember very clearly, and a couple other things, but it was a lot of stuff. And what's important, what I want to say to you, is when we got down this list, and I got it spelled out, and I carry most of my notes in that book still, went down it, and they asked me, we kind of went a thing, well, how much do you think you owe this guy? And so he wrote that down. And what kind of amends you got to make to this person? That, not all of them were financial, but probably a good 85% of them. And we got that done, and everybody's kind of relaxed, and I'm just sitting there kind of stunned. And they asked me a really important question. They said, you haven't made any of these amends and you stayed sober. You're the only person we know that's ever done that. It's been our experience that anybody with considerable or substantial sobriety that goes out with unmade amends. Now think about that. Most people, and I don't know what substantial sobriety is. It doesn't have to be 20 plus years like I did. What if it's only two or three? But you've been a quality AA member, and you've been working with others, and maybe doing some service and some other thing. And you find yourself trapped, and you go back out and drink. just about everybody that I know of, and I think it probably is everybody I know of that's gone back out, that were surprised to me that they went out, and Bob and other people we've gossiped about when we do that. We don't gossip in AA, but it may be important for us to gossip about the guy or the gal we've watched that have gone back out. Maybe we can learn something from them. And so I'll throw that out. We've got all these people we know that have gone back out and gone back out with unmade amends. I'm not sure I believe it's the unmade amend that causes us to go back out. But what if I'm wrong? Very likely is. So I kind of toss that out. But we came with that list, and I was sent home, and all they could tell me to do is, we'll help you any way we can to help you make that amends and get out of the way of that and do that. And what I didn't know was the kind of Paul, kind of sponsor that Paul Martin was. But he would call me at least once a week, and he would remember. I think he had a photographic memory. Because one week he'd ask about this amend, and the next week he'd ask me about a different amend. How he fired it? Did you give him any money? Did that and that? Going through that. So I had no idea I was going to get weekly or sometimes more than weekly help in making my amends. But mostly it was Paul Martin's foot in my ass to get it done. So that Sunday night I go home. And I know that's something that's got to get done this time. I've run my string. I don't have any more slack in Alcoholics Anonymous. This is it, and I believe that today. This is it. I can't do that kind of shit again. And so I got home and I sat down with Julie and I showed her the list, and it says, these are all the amends I got to make. And she looked at that list and she says, Gary, I was with you 80% of the time when you went out and borrowed that money. She says, I even signed on some of those notes with you. Those are as much my amends as they are yours. And I haven't been paying attention. And she made some thoughts about herself that she had had, but the bottom line was, if she hadn't done anything about them either. And so we were convinced that those had to get done. If we didn't get anything else done, we had to take care of all that debt. So back then was before spreadsheets. Excel did not exist to my knowledge. And so I went down to the stationery store. What they had was what they called columnar pads. And I think this one had like 24 going down and 18 columns going across. And so you list all the people you were making amends to here, and then there's just dates going down. And as you got money, I paid it as far down as I could go to each column. And the next time I got money, I'd go on down to the next one and go on that. And so payday would show up, and I would go upstairs and I'd go through that. Julie would come up while I'm doing it and see where I was and remind me that the kids may need shoes or lunch money, or we got to put a tank of gas in the car so she can go to work and I can catch a meeting or two. And that's what we did. And it went on week after week after week. And a day came. And I want to say that went on for close to a year. And I was up there this one night, and I got it, and I could see clearly how much headway I was making, but it didn't feel like I had made that much headway with doing that. And I went downstairs, and I guess I was looking for a little sympathy, and I was talking to the wrong damn woman, but I said, you know, I wonder if I'm capable of making enough money to get all these amends paid for. hadn't done any principal's inventory yet. And I really, it just almost looked impossible. And it hadn't looked impossible before that incident as I did that. And she didn't have anything to offer to that. And so the next morning comes around. And I come downstairs, and she's fixing breakfast for the kids and I. And she says she has an idea. And for you married guys, when she says she has an idea, it might be good, but you might want to cut and run. But I listened to her, and her idea was, she says, I think I have a way we can make all these amends. She said, we've lived in this same house longer than we've lived anywhere. And we actually, it has appreciated in value. And we can probably get a sizable chunk out of the house. She says, you've worked in this same job longer than you've worked on a job anywhere. And you've done well, and you've made money, and we have that 401k that's got all that money in it. She says, we could cancel that retirement money. We could sell the house, and there'll be enough there to make all of our amends, plus some current debt that we threw in that amends pile. And there'll be enough money left over that we could move into a used trailer house. Now, those are her words. I called it a mobile home because it gave it a little class. But I couldn't believe she was saying that. Thank God, she can't be serious. And so I hurried up and got to work just to get away from her. And I come back that night and I walked in and I said, well, maybe we better call Paul and see what he says about that. And I'm just thinking he's got a way out of this. He's got to have. And so I called him and I told him about our discussion of selling the house, cashing in the retirement, moving into a trailer house. And I said, how crazy does that sound? How loco is that? And he says, Gary, it's the sanest thing I've heard you say in 20 years. Whose idea was it? And I said, well, it was Julie's. And he said he thought so. So as I recall, that conversation took place in fall, September, October, something like that. And the real estate market wasn't as hot as it is now by a long way, but February 28th, we sold the house. We had cashed in the retirement. And I got on the phone, and I started calling these people to make amends. Just to get that started. I had started, like I said, I made some amends. Let me go back to those first. Some of the first ones I made amends to before we sold the house, and that were the ones I was the most embarrassed by. While I was going to school at the University of Wyoming, I had a part-time job where I was the oldest student that worked at this men's clothing store. And so very often I was left in charge there to manage other students and that sort of thing. But I really took advantage of him, and some clothes walked out the door of that store that I never paid for. And his name was John Davis. And I called him, and I don't know if he was first or last, but I called him. And I told him why I was calling. I was going to AA when I was in Laramie and that. And I said to John, I said, this is Gary Brown. Do you remember me? And he says, yeah. He says, are you still going to those meetings? And I said, yeah, that's why I'm calling. And so I explained to him what I had done and how I needed to make that amend to it and make it back. And I made him a deal where I was going to send him $50 a month, which was tokenism, but that's what I thought the best I could do. And I started doing that with him. And I started making some payments to the parents and to a friend of ours in AA that had loaned us some money, and he showed up later on the list. And he had died, and what was Dick's wife's name?
Grant?
Yeah.
Dick Grant.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Can't think of his wife's name. Oh. Anyway, Dick had died, and I had to send the money to his wife. I found her and sent it to her. She was living out in California then. There's some other ones I was making as I went along in there. And going along and got plugging away and making some headway on them. And this one week I didn't get a commission check. Didn't happen. And I got a call from John at the clothing store. Wanted to know where his $50 was. I told him, I said, I didn't get a commission check, but it's coming. I promise you it's coming. I got to get you and everybody else paid off. And I was serious, and he was real quiet on the phone. And he said, no, you don't have to pay me. I'm in good shape. We're retired. We're living out here in the mountains outside of Laramie. We got it made, and I really don't need the money. I don't want you to pay me. And so he forgave me the money. Now, I'll come back to this story here in a little bit. So time goes by. We sell the house. We cash in the retirement. And I'm calling people that I hadn't got to yet. But first thing I did was call John back. And I said, what's your address? I got the money to pay you now. And he forgot he forgave me and gave me the address, so I sent him a check. Had I told Paul Martin that I'd let him get by with forgiving me that debt, there'd have been hell to pay. And there would have been. I heard somebody call him and ask him, he said, I can't find this guy I owe the money to. He says, can I give it to the lead dog people for blind people? And he said, did you steal the money from them? He'd say, no. He says, go find them. And he was that way. Of course, later on, the internet comes along and we find everybody now. If we're trying. There was a man in AA that had been a close friend of mine since we were in Houston in 1977 down at that WIPAW conference and talking at that. A good friend of mine, and his name's Bob. He lives in St. Paul, Minnesota. And he had called me one day before we had to make the amends, and before I did the inventory thing. And he wanted to stop by to see Julian I, because he was giving an AA talk somewhere, Virginia or here, I don't know where. And he was going to leave a day early and spend the night with us in Indianapolis and fly on down. And he came in there, and I met him, and we had a cup of coffee, and he looked me in the eye, and he said, you look terrible. What's going on? And I says, I'm scared to death. I said, I've been behaving badly, spending money where I shouldn't be spending and doing that. And they're going to foreclose on the house Monday morning, and Julia doesn't know it, and I'm afraid it'll kill her. And so I just got relief telling him, because I hadn't told anybody. You didn't know about it, nobody else. And so we're driving out the house, driving past downtown, when Bob says, where's the bank? And I said, what bank? He says, the one that has a note on your house. I says, well, it's right downtown here, just a few blocks. He says, let's go with them and have a talk. Go over there and have a talk. I says, Bob, they're really tired of talk. They've had all the talk they want. And he said, well, you never know. And so we go down there. I park across the street. He and I are jaywalking across the street to go in this bank, and I felt like I was going in to see the principal with my dad. And we walked in there, and when they were giving us this one little room, and I'm sitting back by the wall as far away from the desk I am, and Bob's right up immediately behind the desk. And this very angry-looking banker come in with a stack of papers. And he says, Bob says, the conversation was quick and easy. He says, how much does it take to get Gary caught up on his payments? And things looked more hopeful to the banker because the expression changed. And he gave him the number, and it was a pretty good-sized number, a few thousand bucks. And Bob was carrying that in cash and traveler's checks. And, you know, 15 minutes later, the papers are signed, and we're walking out. And I'm stunned. I don't know what to say. And we're jaywalking back across the street, and I says, "Damn, Bob, I got to pay that back." And he said, "That's your problem." Now, flash forward, whatever it was, a year later maybe, or less, I call Bob, and I said, "Give me your address. I can pay you back that money you gave me to save the house." And he laughed at me. And he says, I said, "What's so damn funny?" And I think he met me through Bob White, who always called me Cowboy for some reason. And Bob says, "Well, Cowboy, it's like this. When I gave you that money, I was making money faster than Linda and I could spend it. And we were tithing and we were doing everything, but we felt like it wasn't enough." And he had a business that just made a lot of money. He was in the real estate business, particularly buying and selling apartment houses. But the tax laws back then allowed you to take advantage of things like accelerated appreciation, which generated a hell of a lot of cash for the owners, and that he was making all this money. Meantime, since he'd bailed Julie and I out on the house, Congress changed the law. And all of a sudden, what they were doing then was no longer legitimate to do. And he had all this real estate around the country that he owned that was only generating rent money. And all the tax benefits were gone. He had investors on their neck wanting their money. And he was actually on effectively a salary, an allowance, he called it. And he says, "I have been staying very honest with my sponsor. And he says, I have not talked about this in the podium out there. I've not mentioned it to anybody else in AA. But I talk to Don every week just to make sure I'm staying honest with all this debt and heat he's getting from everybody involved with it." And he says, "It's a crazy thing, because back then we were making all that money and we were looking for other ways to add to our tithe. And so we would find somebody in AA that he thought needed the money, or he and Linda would think needed the money. Call Linda and say, how about this one, this and this and that?" And she either, I think she had yay or nay approval, I don't know. But several people were given money by Bob and Linda to bail them out, and he hasn't told anybody. He says, "A couple times a week, I'll walk down to the mailbox and check my post office box, and there'll be a check in there from somewhere." So people were paying their bills back like honest people should do. And they were showing up at a time when Bob was really in bad need of it. And so we're watching this thing that goes around in AA that comes back around, that this power that Bob's been talking about here has everything to do with. And it's stuff we can't do left to our own devices. The day I got home, the day after I got home from doing all the fifth steps and making my amends list, we decided we would start with Julie's parents. And so I called him on that Tuesday night, and his name was Ellis, and I said, "Ellis, I'm calling for you because I'm trying to get some character in my life. And a lot of that is to do for me to be straight with you. You've been wonderful to me no matter what is going on. I worried you to death the way I took care of Julie and your granddaughter. And you never once have said an angry word to me, and I know you were angry. Who the hell wouldn't have been with that? And you've loaned us money we promised to pay back, and I haven't paid it back. And I've done all that, and that's only one reason I really love you." And he said, "Oh, shit," and he handed the phone to Grandma. And so I go through the same thing with her about that. And then I said, have you any idea how much money you've given us over the years? And she said, right down to the last penny. And so we paid that back. And that was part of it. But we got them all paid. We lived in the trailer for a few years. It's a good way to live. I mean, they're really not a bad way about it. So somebody looks at you funny because your trailer trash, and you give them the finger and move on. I don't think I ever did that, but I know I only thought two words. And we lived in that mobile home 3 or 4 years. And then business was coming back, and I was making some money again. Julie wanted to get in another house, and so we did that. We're in the second house since then. And we run debt-free. Bob and Tim were talking about that earlier. There is a freedom there you don't know if you haven't been there. When the credit cards are current and the car payments are made and that sort of thing, the freedom and the lack of that is working out for you. It sets aside so much. Sometime after I made all those amends, Julie's mom died, and her brother is back in Cheyenne, and he was the one, of course, taking care of the family and the executive of the state and doing all those things. And he had no idea that his parents had bailed Julie and I out with all that money. And so when I did the eulogy, I told the people there, most of it was family and some very close friends to the family with that. And so I shared a bit of this story up there while I was talking about her. I did all the good stuff about how wonderful Grandma was. She couldn't hide the candy good enough to keep my girls from finding it. And that, but then I told about this a little bit about making amends and her knowing every last penny that we owed. And I sat down, and in Wyoming, generally speak, at a funeral, you might have a showing, but after the funeral, everybody goes to the survivor's home, brings food. And that's when you have the wake. That's when the party is, and you're thankful for the life those people have contributed to us. Julie's brother disappeared. And he came back up after a while, and he handed me a piece of paper. And it was a very formal promissory note. The minute I saw it, I knew what it was. But one of the second or third times we took money from her parents, he wanted us to sign a promissory note, because by God, if he signed a note, he'll pay it. Well, it fooled him. But this time it said it was marked paid in full. And John came up, her brother came up to me after that was over, and he said, Gary, my parents never once mentioned to me about the money they'd given you. It was none of my business, and they never said a word about it. So no one else in the family knew except for those that Julie and I told. So what we saw was some really class parents that we'd been with effectively all our lives. So Julie and I had been dating since I was 17 and she was 16. And none of the other family knew it. And it's a big family. I think her dad had like 12 brothers and sisters. But nobody knew it. So I learned a lot of lessons through making those amends. And just call them life lessons and how to get along. You see how the people going out there that we call straight people? That's because they're really straight. They're doing their very best to live the life as they believe God's given them to them to live. And they've done it. And when they do that, they seem to live a life that we would like to have. And I would like to have. I guess that's 8 and 9 for me.
The book says, is this thing on? Yeah, it is. The book says that we made a list of all persons we had harmed and became willing to make amends to them all. And then the next line is, we did it when we took inventory. So if you've written inventory, you got most of your amends on paper already. Then you just have to figure out how to make it right. So after I fifth stepped with Don, went home and did 6 and 7, he said, make a list of all the people you owe amends to and we'll review it and determine how to correct the harm. And so I did that, and then he started asking me some tough questions. He said, what are you going to do about your dad? And I said, not anything. And he said, well, you need to make amends to him. And I said, for what? He's the one that created all the problems. And he said, didn't you hold him at arm's length your whole life because he was an alcoholic? And I said, yeah. And he said, why'd you do that? And I said, he used to try and call me every year on my birthday, and he was always so drunk that I couldn't even understand him. And he said, do you have any idea how hard it is for a chronic alcoholic to take one day out of the year and find you? And I said, yeah. And he said, well, he was trying to contact you and you blew him off. And I went, right. And he said, that's harm. And I said, I don't give a shit what it is. I'm not going to do it. And he said, then I'll take you down to the New Yorker bar and buy you your first drink. You will make amends. And I said, I think that's a miscarriage, and but I'll do it. And then he said, what are you going to do about all these people you hurt when you were collecting money? And I said, you know, I could go to some of those people, but not some of the others. And he said, why not? And I said, well, some of the people that borrowed money from gangsters are other gangsters. And sometimes they get behind, and then you got to go see them. And, you know, going to some psychopath like myself and saying, I'm really sorry for cracking you in the knee with a baseball bat. And I'd like to know how I can make amends. They're just going to pull a gun out and shoot you. And I said, I'm not going to get killed to make amends. And then I just looked at him and waited for him to agree with me. And he looked at me and so help me, he said, well, God either is or he isn't. And I said, wrong answer. And he said, Bob, amends are one of the best ways to learn how to trust God. And I'm sitting there going, not like that. No, somebody's got to convince these gangsters to leave me alone. And so I went to this hospital that the Grand Army Home. It's an old hospital in Wisconsin for veterans. And my dad was in there. And he had had a stroke and wasn't supposed to be capable of continuous thought, that he was pretty much fried. So I told Don, why the hell would I make amends to somebody that doesn't understand? I mean, then I'm just making a fool out of myself. And he says, Bob, in the book it talks about cleaning off your side of the street. Doesn't say anything about their condition. Which I didn't think was reasonable, but... So I got in my car and I drove to Wisconsin from Colorado and went into this place, this hospital. And I said, I'm looking for a guy named Bob Olson. And they said, that's him right over there in the wheelchair. And so I walked over there and I stood in front of him and he looked up and he didn't recognize me. And I said, hi, I'm your son, Bob. And I need to speak with you. I'm in a fellowship called Alcoholics Anonymous. And the reason why I'm there is because I'm an alcoholic and I don't have to drink anymore. But part of our recovery program is for me to make amends to you for the way I've harmed you. And I took him off into this little side room and I went in there and sat down in front of him. When I told him I was an alcoholic, he looked kind of sad. And when I told him I didn't have to drink anymore, he looked like he was elated. And I sat down and I said, you know, I've held you at arm's length my whole life because of your alcoholism until it was our alcoholism. And I need to do everything I can to make that right. My dad had adult onset diabetes also, besides having a stroke. And they were taking, they had cut his feet off. They didn't know what to do with diabetes back then. And so they amputated his feet, because what happens with diabetes, if you don't control it, is that it attacks your extremities and you get gangrene, basically. So I told him that I would try and contact him more often and see what I could do. And it's kind of hard to talk to somebody that can't talk to you. And so I was there for probably half a day, and then I left. And not long afterwards, I get a call from my Uncle Leif, and he says, your dad just died. They had called him, and they said, we can just keep cutting pieces off of him, but at some point, there won't be any pieces left. And so we have to make a decision at some point about whether to let him die or not. And we can do that now, or we can keep having these surgeries. And it was my uncle's opinion, and I've never questioned that, that was a good time. Now, my dad couldn't speak, but he knew at some point, at some level, that they were going to let him die, and he had nothing to say about the decision. And so when people would come around him, because he couldn't speak, he would scream. You know the four horsemen of alcoholism are terror, bewilderment, frustration, and despair. I honestly believe that despair is the worst. And he was in despair. So he died. I felt nothing. Nothing at all. And I thought, I truly am a psychopath. I mean, I had been described as a sociopath, someone who doesn't give a rat's ass about anything. And I thought, I must be, I'm a psychopath, I'm a sociopath, I'm something like that. Because my dad just died and I can't even shed a tear. So I went to my sponsor and I said, I'm really wired wrong. I think I'm kind of a menace to society. And he said, no, it doesn't have anything to do with that. Your parents weren't around when you were growing up, and you think that you have to have this father knows best experience, and you didn't have that. You were farmed out. You never built a relationship with your father except when he was drunk and taking punches at you. And I said, okay. And he said, you're not crazy. You just had a different experience growing up. And I said, well, by God, when my mother, if anything happens to my mother, I'll have a different response. My mother gave me away when I was 10. And I went and lived on farms and foster homes and stuff. So then my mother dies. And she even made me executor of her estate and all that stuff. But I had no feeling. And I went back to Don and I said, I am a sociopath. I mean, aren't you supposed to feel something about your mother? And he said, she wasn't there either when you were growing up. And she gave you away when you were impressionable. And you grew up in these weird families where you were child labor. And there's no reason why you ought to feel anything. And I said, I think that's a problem. And he said, how would you feel about your kids? And I said, I would jump in front of a bullet for any one of them. And I'm not bullshitting you, I would. And he said, what if one of them died? And I said, it would absolutely break my heart, no question about it. And he said, there are your normal responses. So I went back to Chicago to make amends to all these other people I knew. And obviously I wasn't shot. I call these people and I'd say, do you remember me? And they go, oh yeah. And I said, I'm sober in a fellowship, and I need to make amends to you for my behavior. And they said, well, what do you want to talk about? And I said, I treated you very poorly, and I want to do whatever I can to make that right. Now, more than half of them said, just stay the hell away from me. And I said, okay, and I have. And when there was one family, and this was a guy, this guy lived in Chicago, and he was married to a very large woman. She was about 3 1/4 if she was an ounce. And I went out there to get some money from them, and the guy said, well, come on in. And they had this big oak door on an old house. And when I got halfway, like this part of my body was through the door, and this woman threw her body against the door. And the guy took their German Shepherd around to the outside and had the dog attack my bottom half. While I was pinned in the door by his wife. And that'll raise all your adrenaline. And so I pushed that woman out of the way, and I got inside, and they're both looking at me like, oh God, now we're gonna die. And they said, what are you gonna do? And I said, first I'm gonna kill that dog, and then I'm thinking about killing both of you. And I scared the bejesus out of them. And they gave me a bunch of money, and I left. And anyway, I went back to make amends to them. And actually, they were very nice about it. Oh, Jesus. So, I went and made all the amends. I also had a bunch of financial amends. And it took, I just set up a program that was similar to what Gary described, where I took 30% of my income and I sent it to people that I owed money to. And over the next 3 years, my income went up substantially. And in a little short of 3 years, I was paid off. Now, about 6 years later, I had a business that failed. And I owed $250,000. And by some unexplainable miracles, I paid off that $250,000 in 90 days. And I went to Don, and I said, Don, it took me almost 3 years to pay off like $20,000. And it took 90 days to pay off $250,000. How do you explain that? And he said, it doesn't require explanation. And I said, what do you mean? And he said, God's got all the money he needs. Okay. My life's been like that. You know, I got out of debt. I've never been back in. I became, instead of being a spendthrift, I became an aggressive saver. And as a result of that, I'm planning on spending a few years now just doing fun stuff. My amends these days are generally around my family, and I don't, if I get around something that's going to require an amend, I avoid it. And I will have amends, but they're not the kind that I had in the beginning. They're easier. And I just go make them. Most of the time these days, I try and make them when I cause them. So, you know, my life today is free. I don't know anyone in amend today that I'm aware of. And as a consequence, I sleep like a baby. And I got to tell you, last night I slept like a baby. It's nice. There's a line in the book about not having to cross the street for anyone. That's pretty good stuff. There's nobody looking for me. I'll tell you a funny thing. Gary and I were both given a talk in Amarillo, Texas, not long ago, and the voice of the convention was an FBI agent from Madison, Wisconsin. And because, anyway, I was a Friday night speaker, and I went up to this guy and I said, I'm a little ambivalent about giving my story here because of you. And I said, I was involved in a lot of criminal activity, and especially around organized crime and all that stuff, and I really want to just give my story the way it should be presented, but I'm a little reluctant to do that in front of you. And he said, I understand that, but that's cool. And I said, all right. So I got up and gave a talk. And then Saturday night, when Gary's getting up to talk, before he gets up and talk, this guy gets up in front of the whole group of people from Amarillo and said, oh, and just so you know, I called the Madison, Wisconsin office of the FBI to find out if there were any wants or warrants for Mr. Olson. And he said, thankfully, there aren't any. And I, you know, I was extremely pleased. But that shit comes back to haunt you years later. And it was cool. So, you know, I've gone out to try and make sure everything's okay. And I love leading a quiet life. You know, I love my kids and I do everything I can to support them. There's a couple of ladies that I'll go take to dinner and do that, so I have people that I can be social with. People say, don't you dislike living alone? And I went, no. No, I really love living alone. And every morning when I get up, and I have this king-size bed, and I throw my arms out like this, and when I don't run into anything else, I go, thank you, God. Thanks.
I think Bob and I are going to call it a night. We can do 10, 11, 12 in the morning.